We've got a devilish little Kickstarter here for all you geeks and ghouls for the Halloween season. Throwing Horns. It's a light RPG of devils, demons, and metal. You play a literal band of demons touring the best and worst venues in hell. The promoter, or aka the GM, will guide you on the tour and throw encounters in your path, which you can overcome in the most metal ways possible. Use headbanging tunes, your demonic commanding presence, or just good old-fashioned violence to beat encounters and continue. This is a Kickstarter from a friend of ours that only has through the month of October to raise its funds, so definitely go to throwinghornsrpg.com or just hit up the link on our homepage at gypodcast.com. Donate, get some extra stuff if you reach the right tier of donation, and keep on throwing them horns.
The views and opinions expressed on Geeks Under the Influence are that of the panelists and not of our sponsors, Amazon.com and TeePublic. Parental discretion is advised.
It is weird to look at some of the movies that you were obsessed with when you were younger and look at it from an adult perspective, because what you recognize about it is entirely different as an adult. Like with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because of how the film starts out, where it comes off like it's a portrayal of things that happened in Texas, where this is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it at a young enough age. I was maybe like, I don't know, like 12.
Mm-hmm.
When
damn, that's young for that.
Yeah, pretty young. I remember thinking that this was something that maybe they went overboard with the dramatization, but this definitely happened. And it was later than I'd like to admit before I found out that it was actually more just an homage to Ed Gein and that whole thing than an actual Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Well, it was way less of an homage to Ed Gein and way more Toby Hooper shopping at the holiday time and then looking at a rack of chainsaws and looking at the crowd and going, I know how I could get through this crowd a lot faster.
Right.
Hell, I could probably just rev one of those and they'd get moving.
That's the American way.
Well, I mean, that's actually something that I encountered in a bunch of like his interviews where he was like, he doesn't mention Ed Gein at all. He's just like, you know what would make people move? And then he went home and he was like, I have an idea.
I would also say that homage is maybe the wrong word.
Okay.
It's maybe more like inspired by the villainous nature of that guy and what he did.
The greatness of Ed Gein.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Tell your kids.
But I believe that some of the original advertising was like based on a true story, quote unquote, which doesn't mean anything as an adult. Like, you know that that is dog shit. It means
they still do it, though.
They did it with strangers.
Yeah. Strangers that are like based on a true story. It's like, not really. It's kind of based on the Manson murders, but that's not a, you know. There's nothing in the Manson murders where they're wearing hoods and shit like that.
But when you're like 12 and you're like based on a true story and there's a dude with like a skin mask with a chainsaw chasing fucking like early 20-somethings through the fucking woods.
Right. You're just like, wow, this is real.
Wow, okay. There are truly monsters in the world.
Well, he was just thinking, make America Gein again.
Oh no. Get out.
And he beat you to the pun.
Oh, no.
Now that you're slipping. My God.
Yeah, I mean, you've been off in your game with the dad jokes for a minute.
I have been.
Yeah, last episode, I think Steven kind of took over that shit, man. Get on your A game there.
Imitation is the best form of flattery, so I figure that other people doing dad jokes, it's just, it feels good. It feels good in my heart that I have created that safe environment for people to be able to dad joke properly.
Feels good that people can make Ed Gein dad jokes at you. Okay, that's good. Yeah. Are you looking for a new house decorator as well?
I need some new lampshades for sure. Oh, okay. So we'll work on that.
I've got good news. There's a cemetery real close by.
Speaking of, I exposed Amy Bogart to Texas Chainsaw for the first time. We watched it on the projector out in the yard, which was a great way to enjoy
it
for the first time. And she enjoyed it very much, but also I think just how dirty that house was part of the terror for her. Because there's chicken feathers everywhere. Like, there's one chicken in that room, and there are 30 chickens worth of feathers in that room.
And the whole motif of that film, like, the whole film oozes sweat, like Texas summer sweat.
Yeah. It looks like if the police like raided Rest in Pieces and then just turned everything over. That is what Texas Chainsaw.
Oh, I thought you meant like Sting, like the police. I was like, oh, well, that's
that would also be interesting, though.
Yeah, Sting shows up to Rest in Pieces. We're gonna ruin your shit. Starts knocking shit over.
Yeah, that would be a good Funny or Die episode.
Yeah, right.
I mean, every breath you take.
You get Sting like pulling off his glasses like Caruso in fucking Miami. Sting's like, this is a Sting pulls off the glasses.
Oh, man. No. Oh. No.
Yeah.
There he is.
Yep.
There he is.
I feel like this needs to be like a Seth Rogen kind of comedy with Sting as a like undercover agent.
Oh, I thought we were casting Seth Rogen in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because I was like, yeah, I guess that would work with his height and the hair.
He would have to be,
put a mask
he would
on
have
him.
To be the dude in the wheelchair. Like, he's,
that would be
no,
awesome.
That's, that, no, that's mean. No, I do not want him, because I hate that character in the wheelchair.
Oh, I hate it the worst. It's the worst. The fucking worst.
But you have to have him doing his laugh while he's getting shot by the chainsaw, right? If you're going to have Seth Rogen in there, he has to do that laugh. And like, oh,
no, I wanted him... I want him to be Leatherface, because I want him to, like, and then, like, hack people and have, like, some fucking
so
funhouse laughter moment.
You want Leatherface mocking his victims right before he kills them. Then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Okay.
Well, which, not? No matter which way you slice it, we're going to be talking about Texas Chainsaw and Tobe Hooper and all the other films that Tobe Hooper has brought to this world on this episode of Geeks on the Influence. Episode 197.
Damn.
So welcome to Tobe Hooper for Potoween.
With an ejaculation of sound, from the heavens tumbling down to the pistol streets where the heart of urban man beats.
Woo!
Oh yeah.
Or as Leatherface would put, I recently did a rap, as some of you may know, where Leatherface had a drum solo where he moaned during, and I didn't get the pitch right. It should have been a little bit more higher pitched from having recently rewatched Texas Chainsaw. I apologize. That was the only problem with that rap.
That was it. Everything else was perfect.
Perfect. Pitch perfect.
You were going for Texas Chainsaw 2, where he gets a little more guttural when he like humps her with the chainsaw.
Yeah. More guttural voice, bigger chainsaw.
Yeah.
That should have been the tagline for Texas Chainsaw 2.
I mean, it would work for me.
That would have been a great like addition to the sequel for 7. Instead of like just a cock knife, it would be like cock chainsaw.
Oh, no.
Look, we called that Mandy.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That was the working title for Mandy, was cock chainsaw.
Right.
Again, I'm in.
And if I can make that the title of this episode, I will.
Yes.
So. What I loved with Texas Chainsaw 2 was they went with, for the like cover of all the characters, a Breakfast Club knockoff pose.
Yep.
Yeah.
For Texas Chainsaw 2, which for that really informed that this isn't going to be like Texas Chainsaw, although there are some wacky moments in the original, not nearly the slapsticky fucking shit that was Texas Chainsaw 2.
Right.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, no. By far and wide, he went from like subtle red humor to like, hey, some fucked up people that know like we're going for something a little over the top within horror, are they're gonna chuckle at this, they're gonna find this funny. And then he was like, you guys didn't think that was funny, all right,
well here we go.
Fine.
Now the Breakfast Club on this episode of Geeks Under the Influence that are gonna help us on our voyage through Tobe Hooper's entire catalog is some time-tested lovers of horror. To my left, the co-host of both From the Mouths of Madness and Beautiful Disasters, coming in remotely, is Fuck You Hunter.
What's up, bitches?
We got you on the big screen in the studio.
That's right.
Hell
it's weird.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I've done a Zoom one in a while, so this is definitely interesting. So
yep. But what's nice is we have you on a big screen, so you can see us, we can see you. Makes it a little easier with the zooming.
Yeah.
A bit.
Yeah. But, I'm hyped to cover this episode. It's fucking going to be awesome.
It looks like you're rocking the Sam Adams Oktoberfest.
Oh, yes. Yeah, last time I went to Kroger, they were out, and they just shelved. So I grabbed a couple six-packs.
Fair enough. Next to the TV that Hunter is on is a burlesque performer, entertainer, comedian, and podcaster, contributor extraordinaire. We've got Murphy Lawless here.
Hi, friends.
Welcome back.
Why, thank you.
We haven't had you on in a second.
I know. I thought that restraining order was going to go through any day now.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it, and we just didn't have enough proof
to justify the restraining order. So.
Oh, see, that's why you got to print out the messages I send you so they can see how many Google links I sent you today.
Okay.
Well, you also have to weigh your contribution to the podcast with as prepared as you always are with whatever inappropriate stuff you might bring to the table.
I put a shirt on this time, okay?
And there's a guarantee Murphy is always way more prepared than anybody else on the podcast.
So, I'm less prepared
today. Showrunners, anybody.
So disappointed in myself. I'm much less prepared today because, like, I did my research with the films and everything, and I watched a ton of videos, but I didn't take as many notes, and I didn't
that
find as
you're
many.
That means unprepared for you. That means you're overprepared for us.
I think the phrase is, bitch, are you for real? You posted like 5 links to documentaries and fucking like interviews with Toby Hooper. Like, you did way more
great.
Work. They are good, but you did that.
Next to Murphy, my co-host on this episode, unfortunately, Lowdown is, well, fortunately, actually, Lowdown is moving. And so schedule is kind of crazy right now. And because of that, we've got in his chair a long-standing member of the Geeks Under the Influence family and a co-runner of Beautiful Disasters. We've got Herr Krutz with us here.
Yes, indeed. And it's great to be here during Halloween season.
Halloween season.
Halloween.
Spooky
Halloween.
Season.
Yeah.
And just like all things horror. I know all of the podcasts are basically just like horror. Let's do this. Love it.
Well, there's variations on. There's Beautiful Disasters, which is horror and some sci-fi. And then there's Mouse Madness, which is horror. And there's GUI, which is sometimes horror. Yeah, some nuanced differences between
huge,
the different
huge variety.
Big variety of differences.
I mean, Geek Father involves having children. That's frightening to me.
That is the true horror.
Oh, my God. I didn't even think about that. It's Halloween all year round on his podcast.
Right? So let's dig
That's
in.
Funny.
I do want to kind of get to the meat that everybody wants to talk about. On
the secrets.
Hold on.
Wait up 1 minute, bro.
Yeah. Oh.
Oh. I totally forgot that we have to introduce.
Yeah, we do. Oh my gosh. Isn't there someone else here that's a little fucking important?
Indeed. The progenitor.
Ew.
Of the GUI network.
Would you prefer patriarch?
No, progenitor sounds like something you drink when you're old.
I was thinking someone that mounts something else, but that's
okay.
Fine.
The sire vampire, the badass that made GUI.
That's right. I'm the head of this household.
I'm, of course, talking about the vampire hobbit next
Ooh.
To me.
Oh, no. I think we should go back to crop top hobbit because crop then we top. Can make a parallel to chop top.
Chop top, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was crop top on the last episode, so I guess I'm chop top on this one.
Yeah.
Which makes me
feel
lovely, so I'm good with that.
Yeah. All right. There you go.
Yeah, I am the head vampire. You kill me and you kill all the dick jokes, so...
There you go.
I don't like that.
No. I am Mike the Hobbit, the founder of Geeks Under the Influence and co-runner of the network, and here your host on this cavalcade of fun through the blood-soaked corridors of Toby Hooper's career.
Yeah, as you downplay the fact that you're also co-host on Deeply Unsettling and
Upsetting
and fucking Smack My Pitch Up.
Yeah.
And... You know, how many other shows do you do?
Those are the ones I'm doing currently.
Okay.
We have put Booze Clues on hiatus, and there was Quite Contrary, which is like an old legend that is told from the network. It's not even available online at the moment, though. I'm working on maybe getting some the like 7 episodes of that podcast up for people's curiosity.
Fair enough. One day.
So,
but you did use that as a leverage to get us to argue in a garage.
Yeah, there is something in the works, a game that is being developed based on a long defunct GUI network show. So we'll see how that works.
It was a lot of fun. So keep your eyes peeled for it.
Yeah, I'm excited to see where that goes. But what we're going for on this episode is talking about Toby Hooper. It is a director that is left out of the conversation sometimes when it comes to slashers, though.
Which is
Carpenter
remarkable.
Is thought of as being the one that created like the slasher genre with Halloween. Right before that was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, mm-hmm. older than fucking Halloween.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of the OG one. I
it
mean,
is
like,
the OG.
Yep.
What's the proto slasher? I would say.
Well, it's kind of funny that like the two kind of starter slasher movies are both based on Ed Gein. With Psycho and then Texas Chainsaw.
Sure.
Like, those are your two, in my opinion, kind of pivotal slasher movies, and then you get Carpenter's Halloween.
That's true. I would also argue that Texas Chainsaw Massacre beats out Laurie Strode for the first Final Girl, because she does survive, and she survives in a different fashion than Laurie does.
I should have done some work before this and tried to get an interview with the trucker that pulls over at the end of it, like the actor that portrayed him, because that is one of my favorite moments in the entire movie. Is dude pulls over because there's a woman covered in blood screaming, and he's like, oh shit. And then she comes running out the door, and then he sees Leatherface and goes, oh fuck no, and then crawls out the other side of the truck, and then it's like a beep, 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 like a laughing run around the truck.
But I don't know why he wouldn't just start the fucking truck.
And the thing is, you never
hit
know
that
what
bitch
happens
with
to
a truck.
He just runs off into the woods, like just he leaves his truck. He is done. He's out of it.
I mean, there are probably few things in life that are going to be more unsettling than a giant dude wearing a dead skin mask running at you with a chainsaw. That will upset your entire universe.
Wearing a dead skin mask that has makeup on it because he was still in mother mode.
Oh, was
when
he still
she
in
escaped.
That mask?
She escaped. Wait. Right during like dinner.
Are you saying, oh my God, I didn't even think about this. Leatherface is like the most brutal drag queen of all time?
He is.
Yeah.
He is. Because, and I actually like, this is covered in one of the interviews I listened to.
Yes. I'm not prepared.
I'm not prepared. I don't have notes.
I only listen to 5 interviews as opposed to the 10 I usually do.
I only left one comment on one YouTube video because they left out the thing about him shopping.
Oh my God, you left a comment?
Nice. Look. He was talking about the origins of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and he was like, Ed Gein, and now let's look at Leatherface's beginnings, and then went straight to the new ones, and I was like, you've neglected to mention that Toby Hooper says in all of his interviews about his shopping during the holiday, and it was something more mature than that, but, you know.
Nice.
It was definitely a moment that I commented, and then was like, oh, I need to take a break. But yeah, they were talking about how, like, Gunnar Hansen actually had a couple different masks that he would wear, a couple different flesh masks that he would put on for like the different modes of Leatherface. And one of them was this like when he had the apron on and had, you know, was kind of serving them dinner and used that higher pitched grunt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sort of thing where he also had makeup on the mask. And so like he held himself in a different way. And like the research he did for like the way the body language of that part of his character was very different.
I actually have a latex molded mask from the original Leatherface mask. A buddy of mine who used to go to the Tom Savini school made a mold from the original.
Nice.
And I have that. It's not painted or anything, so it's just like regular peach colored latex, but
that's still amazing, though.
It's in the house.
That's hell yeah. Fucking rad. How have I never known that before?
I don't know. I have a lot of shit.
Yeah, he does have a lot of shit.
It's but true.
I did love that mask that everybody knows Leatherface for having is where it seems really dried out, mm-hmm. where like that the mouthpiece wasn't like cut to be mouth shaped. It's almost like the skin was just like cut in a slit and then peeled away where there's flecks of skin kind of like poking out. And it looks very kind of like haphazardly put together, which made it more terrifying in my opinion.
Okay, but how would you cut around someone's mouth? Like if you were skinning a face, like how are you going to get, because the lips are a very different section of skin from the rest of our face. Like well, what else are you going to do?
He didn't put a face on his face. He put skin sewn together on his face.
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
so I'm it wasn't like the cheek is on the cheek, the forehead's on the forehead. It was just pieces of
the
skin.
The nose is lined up.
Well,
ish.
He had that much creativity, I guess.
Did we ever see what his nose looked like? We don't know where his nose is. Let's not assume.
I think in one of the later remakes, they actually showed him without the mask and he was missing a nose, if I'm correct. But I don't know off for
which,
sure.
Which one? Because
I don't know. They all blend together and they all suck.
Yeah.
But the one with Matthew McConaughey?
Yes, Next Generation for sure.
Oof.
That wasn't Toby Hooper.
No, that was, I think, one of the few things that he had no involvement in because he at least produced the later Texas Chainsaw movies.
He didn't have
directing duties on the third one.
No, directing. He didn't produce either.
He just did one or two.
Yeah. So he just gave the licensing over to somebody else to get Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey.
Well, I feel like we should delve into the effect that Texas Chainsaw had, because I didn't see it for the first time until I was probably like 18, 19 or something like that. I finally got around to seeing it, and I happened to catch this when it came back to theaters as a limited run for the 40th anniversary in 2014. I saw it when I was down in Charlotte, North Carolina, saw it on the big screen, and holy shit, it holds the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is terrifying. Like, you absolutely feel the terror going on.
My son Parker's watched, at this point, a shitload of horror movies. Mm-hmm. But
what, once... your son? Horror movies?
Yeah. Yeah.
Weird.
I know. How did that happen? But he had actually never seen Texas Chainsaw. So kind of like what Hobbit did, introducing it on the outside projector. That was my first test movie on the outside projector, was him watching Texas Chainsaw. And he was really into it and kind of blown away. He's like, "In what year did that come out?" I was like, 74. And he was impressed that, like, a movie from 74 would hold up with the amount of slasher movies he's watched prior to that. So that kind of stands up to show you how strong Texas is.
Not only that, not only came out in 74, but did it on a shoestring budget.
Shoestring.
Like, very, very little funding. Like, worked grueling hours to make this happen. Like, this was a labor of love and literal blood, sweat, and tears. And I actually, like... as y'all know, so for a long time I had night terror, so I had a hard time watching horror. So I've delved into a lot of this recently. And so I watched this within the past couple of years and fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mad that I didn't watch it sooner, because I feel like I would have really enjoyed knowing about chainsaw romantic dances sooner in my life.
Yeah.
And I enjoy them even more now that I know that was Gunnar Hansen realizing that he made Toby Hooper nervous when he swung the chainsaw near him and then flailing it around to make him more nervous.
It's amazing.
It's delightful.
Also, what I love is I read up a little bit on the making of Texas Chainsaw as well, and they were all high as gas.
They were smoking
so much weed, where there's like a scene where running up the stairs and they turn the wrong way at one point. It's because they forgot where they were going in the scene. There's moments of that. But I think that kind of informs the tone of the movie as well. Oh, yeah. Is that these are like kind of hippy dippy types that are talking about like Saturn in retrograde or some shit in the van, and then they're like, "Oh yeah, we ran into the meat family," and that weird contrast between the two. Imagine if you're stoned. Holy shit! That's terrifying.
You were talking about chainsaw dance romance, and the first thing I thought of was Leatherface as Pepe Le Pew chasing the Marilyn Burns character.
Oh my god.
Like
the little hop, like the two of them hop it, like him hopping along.
Exactly.
And they're being like, no.
Just picturing that in my mind as some kind of a mashup is hilarious. But I want to say probably the most brutal part of the movie outside of that chase where she is just screaming her face off is when dude gets like hammered in the head.
Oh yeah.
And just hear the noise. Dunk.
Oh, and those death shakes?
The death shakes are the single most terrifying thing in the entire film for me.
I didn't know that was a fucking thing.
I did not when I saw it. No.
Oh my god.
And so when he started shaking, I went, "What is happening?" It was terrifying.
Dude, that was hardcore.
And
I feel like the audience too, like first time you're watching, the people that are watching in the theater for the first time, you just don't expect, oh, it's daylight and they're explore the house, you know, kind of almost set up like, okay, we'll just wait till nighttime before killings happen. Nope. Daytime, just walk into the wrong place. First dude nailed with a hammer. Like, it's great how they don't just drag it out. It's like, nope, here you go. First victim and move on.
Well, there is enough lead up though, that you get an understanding of the relationships of the characters. There's some time in the van before even the weird hitchhiker dude shows up, and that is the most like weird part of the film for me, is because there's his motivations are unclear as to why he's like cutting his hand, and it's informed later that he's just part of this weird fucking like sadistic like cannibal family. But for that to be the first introduction to what's about to happen to the van people, I feel like this is just a commercial for don't pick up hitchhikers.
I mean, it didn't stop a ton of people in the 80s, but yeah.
Yeah, true.
So I put it together a little bit because the beginning of the film opens with talking about how these graveyards have been desecrated and corpses placed
sure,
in.
Yeah.
And then when I saw this dude and he started acting weird, I was like, oh, okay. I see where you're going with this. I also especially watching it recently, realizing how little blood is actually in that film is remarkable because your brain fills in all the gaps, the meat hook scene, those things.
Yep. Yep.
And it was something that I was really impressed with and something I was really entertained by listening to the interviews. Cause one of the things that Gunnar Hansen said, they're making, I think it was the first remake they were going to do. That was basically just a remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And the lady, their PR person calls him and is just like, okay, so we're going for a little bit more of a dark, psychological kind of thing, not the bloodbath the original was. And he was like, have you ever seen the original?
Very gory.
No, it's really not. It's all left up to what your brain does with it. And I think that is just wonderful. That's one of my favorite things with horror is that your brain will extrapolate.
Now, I do want to touch on Texas Chainsaw 2 before we move on. But 2, there's a very, very clear tonal shift in how 2 is handled versus 1. And now, 2 is part of the 3 movies that Tobe Hooper made for Canon Films. Which,
yes.
There's a documentary called, what's the name of that documentary?
It's like,
you talking about Electric Boogaloo?
Oh, Electric Boogaloo is the name of the documentary, yes.
Oh, that's right. No, yeah.
From what I understand, with Texas Chainsaw 2, he made that, but his real passion in another movie we'll bring up was Life Force, but that's pretty much the deal was, you got to give us a sequel to Texas Chainsaw before we can move on to the stuff you really want to actually make. So
there was not really a lot of heart in the second one, but it was made up for in full slapsticky goodness and Dennis Hopper.
I think Life Force actually came out before Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. But it 85 versus
yes,
86.
Yes, it did. It might have been just when they were released.
Yeah, true.
I mean, that's totally fair. I think
more
Life Force was a logical progression from working on Poltergeist with Spielberg, because I think the effects really made sense to move forward from there.
Yeah.
But with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, I think that it was an opportunity to seize upon the culty elements of it, the goofiness of cannibalism. And not only that, but one of the other things, Bill Moseley, who plays Chop Top in the second one, he had made some short called The Texas Chainsaw Manicurist, where he played the hitchhiker role, picking up the person who had gotten the manicure and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And did that voice and had been visiting with someone else at the studio. And he was like, hey, do you want me to walk this over to Toby? And he got Toby's home phone number and he was like, oh, I'll keep you in mind. And ended up calling him for the role to be Chop Top.
That's amazing.
Cousin.
Deep cut.
Yeah. It's pretty fucking rad. And honestly, I think that that role really informed some of the other horror things we've seen from Bill Moseley since in a positive way. And I think he's grown from the role, but.
Oh, my definitely. Name's Murphy. I didn't do any research.
I did.
Actually, I know where she got that from. So I have also seen that in the dark, in the Search of Darkness.
I actually didn't get that from In the Search of Darkness.
Really?
I got that from some of the interviews I watched today. And I think that they actually mentioned it in some of the Masters of Horror interviews.
Oh, all right. Well, sorry.
You
I
need to push
I just remember from the
up.
Documentary yeah. I watched. So.
Are they you sliding?
Have to, you have No, you have to say, well, actually.
Well, basically. Actually. Texas Chainsaw 1 to 2 is basically Evil Dead 1 to Evil Dead 2.
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
That's the best comparison because, it really does have that tonal shift, like you said. And also, I honestly believe, I don't think he's ever admitted it, but I think Rob Zombie decided he could be a filmmaker after seeing Texas Chainsaw 2.
Yes. I 100% agree.
100%.
Because.
Yeah.
The feel for House of a Thousand Corpses and stuff like that is straight out of 2.
And the fact that House of a Thousand Corpses has fucking Bill Moseley in it.
Right. In a more aggressive, more mature version of Sure. Top Top.
Right, exactly. I mean...
Also, it really does show the acting spectrum of Dennis Hopper relatively well.
That
Dennis
Holy shit.
Dennis Hopper can act his face off and do very good acting. And then he can do...
Which film is that?
Texas Chainsaw 2, which is just... I mean, eat your heart out, any of the actors that we know for scenery chewing with Dennis Hopper in part two.
Well, this was also in the peak period of his cocaine.
Cocaine?
Yes.
His marriage with cocaine.
Yeah, I was going to say, it did really challenge him as an actor. Be like, all right, take these chainsaws and just start fucking shit up, you know, in the tunnels. You're like, just give me 2 seconds in my trailer and I'll be ready to go for at least right. 20 minutes just destroying shit. I'm That's good
right.
to go.
Right. That girl that was helping you, that you used as bait, you don't give a fuck about her. Trap her in there.
Yeah, it's such a weird relationship in that movie with Dennis Hopper and that girl. Because at one point he really wants to believe her and help her out. And other times he's like, I'm just using you as bait to find the motherfuckers that killed my, you know, family member.
But
I can't remember,
know,
was a cousin or nephew or something.
And the light part in all that is that Cook found his ability to kill someone. Because, you know, in the first one, he didn't have the stomach for killing, you know? He just didn't have a taste for it. He did the cooking and that's it. But in this one, he had a grenade saved. I'm proud of him.
Yeah.
Aww.
It shows that there's some real growth that's happening, you know?
That's right.
But can we just be honest, man? Texas 2, it's fun, but goddamn, there's some silly ass shit.
Oh, it's silly as shit, and I own it for a reason. I've watched it more times than I can count because it's... And I understand why there was such a hard turn on appreciation from the first one to the second one, because you expect more of the same. And then you get fucking wackadoo shit in the second one. But it's still a good movie. It's still fun. It's enjoyable. And that's ultimately what you're going for.
It is. And in some respects, like, when it comes to, like, I mean, I think we can safely put this in the horror comedy genre, because it knew what it was.
Oh,
it,
sure.
It never pretended to be anything
different.
Well,
the fact that there's this Breakfast Club knockoff portrait yes. of them suggests that they knew exactly.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. But when you have sinister murder happening and, like, the pre-planning where Leatherface was in the record vault waiting for Chop Top to set up that line for him to come running out at her.
Yeah.
Like, they're goofy, they're kind of stupid, they're fucked up, but they're fucking here to murder people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they are slicing the skin off of someone. They're cooking people and feeding them to others in a Texas chili cook-off.
Yes. The God, best way man. Possible.
Yeah. Now, which actually plays more into Peter Curtin than Ed Gein, but that's beside the point.
Best chilies from Texas is all I'll have to say. So we're going to take a break. Take a listen to some of the other shows are here on the network, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Coming straight from the mouths of madness, I'm Lowdown.
I'm F.U. Hunter.
Do you love horror?
We fucking do.
So this is a podcast dedicated to all things in cinematic horror. We're talking movies, television, composers, special effects artists. We're going to fucking cover it.
So if you love horror,
embrace the madness.
In a world ravaged by movie studios that keep rehashing the same things, only one podcaster has the guts to make it even worse. Join Mike the Hobbit as he traverses the internet to bring you some of the best and worst ideas for reboots, remakes, and reimaginings of some of your favorite and least favorite TV and film properties. Ideas like a John Waters He-Man movie, Fantastic Four the Musical, and Aliens done entirely with marionettes. What podcast would bring this evil upon the world? This is Smack My Pitch Up. Available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, Scotty Big Daddy Preston here, that's right, the Geek Father, asking you to join me here every other week with friends and family of the GUI Network as we go through all the trials and tribulations of being a geeky parent. So remember, join us or cry.
My name is Amy Bogard.
And I'm Mike the Hobbit.
And we are the hosts of Deeply Upsetting, where we use our expertise to answer your most upsetting hypothetical quandaries, such as, what non-wiggin animal deserves wings?
And what body part deserves a secret mouth?
Which cryptid is the worst roommate?
These questions and more that plague you will be answered on Deeply Upsetting, available anywhere you get your podcasts and at GUIpodcast.com. We're back for the second half of Geeks Under the Influence, all things Toby Hooper.
Oh, yeah.
The Hoop Troop, yeah.
The Hoop Troop, yes.
Yeah.
before we get back into the Hoop Troop, we're going to be talking about the people that help us get this podcast going every month with your help. First off, of course, is Amazon.com. I may have spoken poorly about one Jeff Bezos on the last couple episodes. And this episode isn't any different. Fuck Jeff Bezos. But
well, you know what? I will kneel down and bow to him if he decides to spend his insane fortune to wipe out student debt forever in America, like Jeff
which
Bezos.
He could do and not that. Even feel it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's,
no,
that's pocket change.
Yeah.
Yeah. He'd be like, yeah, psh, I got you. Everyone's cool. got no student debt. I'd be like, okay.
Yeah, talk about a boom to the economy right there. A giant middle finger to Trump. It's like, oh, yeah, you hate me? Guess what? Student debt is taken care of.
Wouldn't
fuck
that
you.
Be nice.
It'd be great.
Whatever. But, he loves Trump. He gets all the tax breaks.
Amazon.com, the place where you have probably been leaning on in these recent months to get all your necessities around the house. We also have, including stuff for the podcast as well. So if you want to help us out, continue to shop through Amazon until we get a different sponsor. And just make sure you do it through the link at GUIpodcast.com in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. That way we get credit for your shopping at Amazon for now. And you're spending the same amount on the products that you've come to need from Amazon, and we get credit for it for now. And so that is our Amazon plug. Best one we've done yet. And moving on to
50% less shit talking. Yes.
Yeah, it wasn't as lengthy, but it is girthy.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. And so the next one up, though, is actually our merch is what we're talking about. TeePublic.
Boom.
A TeePublic.
Boom.
We've got all the designs from previous Halloween seasons available. Murphy is wearing our Puzzle Box Bop It Join Us or Die shirt right now. And we've got a bunch of other horror designs for the Halloween season available. Just go to GUIpodcast.com/store. Click on the TeePublic link to find all those designs. We've got like 30 plus designs at this point.
There's a lot
of different stuff from all the different shows on the network. We've got more and more dropping all the time. They have sales all the time. Check it out. Support us by not only repping our merch, so people are like, oh, that's a funny shirt. Where's it from? Oh, it's from this show called Geeks Under the Influence. But also,
and then what happens?
And then the money.
I just see how far this conversation, the scenario you're going into. So,
and then you go, oh, I don't really listen to podcasts. And you're like, it is 2020, dude. How do you not listen to podcasts in 2020? Like, there's over a million active podcasts on Apple Podcasts. And they go, okay, I'm just trying to get a coffee. Why are you talking to me?
Because I have them cornered in the milk section of 7-Eleven.
Yeah, right. No, but the plus side of TeePublic as well is for the time being, all of our profits that we get from sales on TeePublic, we are donating to the Holly Fund, which is a local fund to help local restaurants and restaurant workers during the time of COVID. So there's a lot of people in kind of dire straits right now, depending on what their line of work is, and restaurants are getting hit harder than many. And the Holly Fund helps out when need be in some of these restaurants. Some restaurants are lucky enough to have big patios, or they already have kind of a takeout format anyway, so it works out relatively well. Some are suffering, and Richmond is known for their restaurants, for how many amazing places, and we don't want them to go anywhere. So help us keep the restaurant scene in Richmond alive, because you get great food for like very reasonable prices in Richmond, and I want that to continue to be a thing. And you can help by just literally buying our merch. All of our profits from it go to Holly Fund, so we're not taking a single penny from it. So that's the way to help. Also, if you buy a mask from our merch, they donate an N95 mask to frontline workers for every mask that you purchase on the TeePublic site. So unfortunately, the nurses aren't getting the live, laugh, love human centipede mask.
They can if it says this was a present from Geeks Under the Influence, and then they look up Geeks Under the Influence and they're like, oh my God, my patients will love this.
Well, that's what you can do as a fan, is buy frontline workers GUI masks to wear and terrify their patients.
I will. Also, I will say that I think that the From the Mouths of Madness is a pretty choice face mask.
Definitely.
Hell yeah.
So that's our sponsorships. Now on to the real fuel of Geeks Under the Influence, the liquid courage that allows us to talk at length about some of our favorite materials. We're talking about what we're drinking.
Hey, we're fucking drinking. We're getting drunk. You want to know? Well, here you go. Hey.
Spooky smash.
Spooky smash.
Oh my god. It's like listening to Smash's slow cuts and trying to be spooky.
We only bring that out for special occasions. That's the spooky smash.
Oh my god. I'm
gonna die. Oh man.
And that broke Murphy.
There you go. Just, oh my god.
I think the way that this ties in for this episode is that I'm pretty sure that Craig T. Nelson is drinking nothing but whiskey the entire second half of Poltergeist.
I mean,
right.
When ghosts steal your daughter through the TV.
Drink up.
No better way to deal with it than whiskey. We've got a couple choices here.
That's right.
Groots, if you want to tell us what we're drinking from you.
Yes. So my share I brought was a lovely birthday present. It's Sazerac Rye. A very delicious rye, a wonderful addition to a cocktail. We got a little ice in it because it is very rye.
Ooh, yeah, that's rye.
It will, but it's goddamn delicious.
It is really good.
I love this rye.
I like a good rye. It's definitely one of those that you like or don't like kind of maneuvers.
I'm into it. I can just feel it burning in all the cracks in my lips that need chapstick from wearing all these GUI masks.
It just
nice.
Thanks.
It's just that really potent sort of like rye cornmeal mash. Like it really gets you and you know you're drinking an American whiskey. So
this is like that perfect whiskey when there's a like a crackling fire outside and it's a little cold where you can wear your hoodie and it's Halloween season and you're sipping, hanging out with your friends, telling ghost stories and drinking Sazerac rye.
Damn right. And it is owned by the Buffalo Trace Distillery.
Hmm.
But
I think it's some of my favorite whiskey.
I think it's made, the company itself is out of New Orleans, so.
Nice. That's a very tasty rye. I appreciate that.
It is indeed.
And Murphy, you are also rocking some whiskey.
I did. I brought something that's a little sentimental to me. My dad was the one that very subtly encouraged a love of horror through randomly mentioning, you know, things like Phantasm and Dust Till Dawn and stuff like that. And
hell yeah.
Walked in on the tentacle scene in Dagon, which totally wasn't awkward. What I have brought to share with you is something that I drink only once a year. My brother brought it back from Ireland for me. It is the Bushmills Distillery Reserve Single Malt Aged 12-Year Whiskey. So it is something that I am very glad to share with friends, and I hope you enjoy it.
I'm super excited because also is a Bushmills release that is not available in the U.S. I've never seen it.
Really?
I have seen most of their releases, and I'm super excited.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I very much enjoy it. It's...
Oh, that is smooth.
That's very smooth.
It's exceptionally smooth. It's not peaty. I do like a peaty whiskey. But...
Well, I get the slightest touch of peat, but I'm also like hypersensitive to peat. But it's mellow enough that I could definitely drink on this no problem. It's...
Well, don't worry. My brother Matt is the one that brought it back, not Pete.
Oh, nice. Wow. Okay. Everybody's nice. Out dad joking me still. This is ridiculous. Bam.
No, I really appreciate a single malt Irish. There are some really good ones out there. Tyr Connell is probably my go-to, but... This is smooth to the nth degree.
Yeah, this is super
that is
smooth.
Outstanding. I could put that bottle down.
Dangerously quick.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
That's
yes.
Part of why I save it for once a year, just because, you know, it's something special to cheers with people I love to someone that I love and just celebrating the good things, because the other things that my dad and I did were build all of our Halloween decorations together.
Well, then
so
another cheers to your father.
Well, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate y'all. And cheers to Hunter. And
cheers to Hunter virtually not being able to drink any of this delicious Irish whiskey. Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
That's okay. So what are you drinking, Hunter?
My go-to till they take it off the shelves. Goddamn Sam Adams Oktoberfest.
Nice.
I'll be honest, this year I think I've had the most of it though, because it came out around my birthday. Murphy actually, I think, hooked up what was it, one of the big like sampler packs that had that in there.
Sweater Weather was, I think, the pack name, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Something like
and
that.
Then everybody else for my birthday just kept bringing Oktoberfest. Mm-hmm. So I think in the span of 2 days, I went through, I don't know, a shitload, and I've just been picking up when I can. So
we drank a significant amount that night.
Yes, we did.
But I'm just proud of myself that I finally brought a share that Groots will actually drink.
That's amazing. Yeah. I'm that guy who's not the beer drinker.
You're fine.
I will
I'm
not have
excited.
Your beer. I will not try it.
Yeah, the German that doesn't.
Not even beer. The cold
put the beer down. I will not put it in my mouth.
All right, so now we're into the some people's least favorite and some people's most favorite part of the podcast. We're talking about the time that we ruin the films that we've come to know and love with yes. Making a drunken scene.
Making a drunken scene.
I love that's become a thing. Like,
it makes me happy.
It's a necessity. We are going to be doing a scene from Poltergeist from 1982. We've got four roles, one of which, and I'll take Marty if nobody wants to take it, because that is four words. The rest
I'll take Carol Ann.
Oh, you want to be Carol Ann?
Oh, my God, yes. I want Hunter to do Carol Ann, definitely.
All right. Yeah, you'd be Diane. I'll be Steve.
Oh, I get to play a girl.
Okay, so Murph is Diane. Groot is Steve. Carol Ann is played by Fuck You Hunter. You don't even have to act in this role. It's basically like you're the same person.
Yeah, so. That's right.
Yeah.
And I will be Marty, delivering the most important line in this entire run of...
It's such a random line.
Be prepared for my line, because really that's what ties this entire movie together, is this one line. It's incredibly important. So, Diane, whenever you're ready.
Ah, this is probably going to seem a little strange. We hear better on this channel. Don't ask me why. Well, I guess I will call her... Carol Ann!
Ooh.
Ah, it's mommy, sweetheart. Ah. We want to talk to you. Please answer me, baby. Please answer me. Please talk to me, bunny.
Look at the dog.
Are you with us now? Can you? Can you say hello to daddy?
Hello, daddy.
Hello, sweet pea.
It's mommy, sweetheart.
Hello, mommy.
Hello, baby. Can you see me? Can you see mommy?
Mommy, where are you? Where are you?
We're home, baby. We're home. Can you find me? Can you find a way to us, baby?
Mommy, where are you? I can't find you. I can't. I'm afraid of the light, Mommy. I'm afraid of the light.
Yay. Also, it is funny that Hunter is doing Carol Ann through a television. So that is kind of perfect.
That is.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a thing that happened.
Yep.
I don't know what voice I was going for there.
Okay. My line, like, look at the dog. Yeah, that was real.
No. You killed it. It was awesome.
Yeah, I was real proud of that.
That
so,
was fun.
This is a perfect lead in to talking about Poltergeist. And
yes.
There's a lot of conversation, both
yes.
with who actually directed the film has been a long running conversation.
Oh, yeah.
It is, I would say, the most successful box office of any of Tobe Hooper's films.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I think you're correct.
And definitely was informed partially by, was Life Force before or after?
After.
After, okay. Life Force was more informed by Poltergeist, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a whole lot under Hooper's roster besides Texas Chainsaw before.
He had done Eaten Alive and the Fun House, but...
Yeah.
This was an interaction where he hooked up with Steven Spielberg, and Steven Spielberg, I guess, really wanted to kind of do this movie, but couldn't, or whatever, contractually, maybe?
I think contractually he was working on something else at the time.
I think that he actually just wanted a horror director's eye for it, because he had just come from E.T., which is significantly more family-friendly. And Spielberg wrote the majority of the script, which there's a ton of differences between the way that, like, the script translated into the film But I think that like the biggest change for Hooper moving into Poltergeist was by far like the level of special effects, because he went from all like what he was used to, where like a little bit of sleight of hand, you know, mm-hmm. what you don't see, you know, very physical, very, very practical effects, to these larger than life things of how they were going to do it.
And I want to say, much like when Spielberg was involved later on with the Goonies, it very much informed how the movie was going to happen. And one of the things that really works in that film, Goonies included, with Poltergeist, is how the child actors are.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How amazing their performances are. And it really adds an authenticity to the entire story, because you feel like these are regular people in a situation, and you really develop a bond with the characters, and that's why you get so invested in the entire film.
Oh, I absolutely agree. No, the actors are fantastic, and honestly, one of the things that I really enjoyed watching, like some of the background for Poltergeist, was there's a Cursed Films episode on Shudder.
Oh, it's so good.
It's yes. so good, but there is a lot of tragedy surrounding the film.
Yeah. The series of Poltergeist.
The
movies.
Series of Poltergeist. Yeah, that's more accurate. Where the in the second one, the older sister is very casually written out from, because the actress was murdered by a boyfriend, and yep. the young actress that played Carol Ann died after the third movie, or in the middle.
Craig T. Nelson did Coach after the series was over.
That's
really tragic.
That's
shit
really
happened.
The most tragic aspect.
It really
of
is.
Ugh.
It really is.
Wow. Well, you know,
wow.
A job's a job, I guess. Damn.
Look, I mean, as discussed earlier, Hooper did Crocodile, so, you know.
Yeah, we're going to get to Crocodile, but I do want to speak to, like, just how you can squeeze in so much fucking terrifying shit into a PG-13 movie.
It was PG. It's not PG-13.
Is it PG?
It's PG.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
I know that because I showed it at Blockbuster when I was a manager, because we were allowed on,
yep.
on Halloween yep, day to show PG like horror movies, and I made a little African-American boy cry, and his mother complained to me, and I was like, oh, put something else on.
Nice. It might be rated PG, but that should at least be PG-13.
Well, why? It was before that rating came okay. about. Why but yes, you're correct.
Why would it be PG-13?
A dude rips his skin off of his face.
That wouldn't do it.
Marijuana smoking.
Marijuana smoking.
Okay.
Okay.
And yep. also the mother getting like a wall and ceiling fondled in
she
her
didn't get
panties.
Fondled. She got she got dragged across the ceiling.
No, you yeah, can get away with that in a PG
movie. She got molested by a ghost up onto the ceiling, and there was kind of a racy scene.
The more aggressive scene definitely happens in the second one, which Hooper did not have anything to do with, especially for the era that we're discussing, which was it 82? That was.
Also,
I mean,
Kids in Danger tends to push it up to PG-13 most of the time.
She wasn't in danger.
Too.
You yeah. didn't see
no,
her
kids,
for the
Kids in Danger.
She, you didn't
like
see
a giant
her the majority
fucking
of the film.
Tree breaking in through the house.
Yeah,
and
well,
then stealing a kid. Like, yep,
but it didn't
I'm going to get me one.
All the way. It's
or the fucking
fine.
Clown.
Okay, oh, we're going to talk about we're going to talk about the trauma of this movie in Nights, right?
Let's just say,
yeah,
I
that's
think
a good Nights.
What works perfectly.
I watched it as an adult, so I unfairly can't comment.
What works perfectly with Poltergeist, I think, is that you have a combination of Spielberg, who figured out building up suspense with movies like Jaws prior, mm-hmm. right? And then you have Hooper with the, I'm going to show you some fucked up shit. So you have the suspense, but then you have the face ripped off scene. You have the suspense, and then you have the clown attacking scene. And it's like this where you just build up, which Spielberg's
oh, like the
really
pool,
good at.
The pool scene with the skeletons is totally Hooper.
Oh, oh yeah.
Yeah, that's clearly Hooper.
But I'm just saying, you have Spielberg recognize, like, I think that's what I think, it's just kind of like a co like working together. Spielberg had a vision, mm-hmm. but you know, Hooper brought out a lot of that.
He did inform you know. Some of the film. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I want to live in the reality where Spielberg and Hooper made five or six films together.
No,
oh my god,
shit. I guess.
How awesome would that have been?
That, oh my god, that is, I'm not even going to sugarcoat this. That's a fucking wet dream.
Yeah.
Holy shit. But it was interesting hearing the differences from what was written in the script, which was penned by Spielberg, to what made it to film. And it honestly was like they made it a little bit sweeter, because at first, like the family was a lot more dysfunctional. Like the husband and wife were so much more nitpicky. Like a lot of the struggle arose from them not listening to each other, from them like discounting their experiences. And like initially, like things were a lot more aggressive. Like the, you know, Caroline slides across the floor, but she was also supposed to slide across again and like go into the wall. Like her helmet would have dented the wall. Where like later on, you know, Craig T. Nelson's character would have mentioned, like, you know, she could have been like, we'd be at the hospital right now if it wasn't for that football helmet. But a lot of that was cut. And given that, you know, E.T. veneer of like, you know, we're translating this because we are trying to operate within those lines. And honestly, I think Hooper also learned a lot of that, because when he made Texas Chainsaw, he went to the censors and was like, how would you make this a PG movie? And then operated within those lines to try to get something where your imagination would grapple and extrapolate.
Do not give the MPAA that much fucking power.
I never, 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 ever, never, never ever on my Cecil B. Demented life. different director, but you know what the fuck I'm talking about. I think that it was brilliant on the part of both Hooper and Spielberg to be like, so what do you consider to be the boundaries? And then be like, oh, these are the boundaries. And then be like, okay, we followed your boundaries. And then just look at them and they're like, I'm really uncomfortable, but fuck, you're not wrong.
Steak full of maggots isn't technically outside of our standards, though it's utterly horrifying. Oh.
What about the big ass like ghost spider thing?
Oh, that was so cool. God.
Did that fuck you up a little bit?
No, that was okay, because it was so not like a real spider that it was just normal creepy.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I'm so glad that they decided to go with like that like ghost spider like spectral figure coming out of the closet, because initially it was supposed to be a man's face, which translated much better to the second film, with them actually seeing like the head of this cult that dragged them all into this like despair of an underworld. You know, seeing the mock-ups of this like face coming out of the closet, it makes so much more sense as this skeletal beast figure, because it's, you know, we're transmuting the metaphorical into the, you know, the physical,
right?
And I think that they did a really stellar job at that. Also, can we just have a moment of bliss for that beautiful blending of practical and special effects?
Absolutely.
Because, oh yeah,
I mean, the whole, like, the ending sequence when they're retrieving the daughter, and it's basically like a fucking birth.
Oh, it is.
Oh, yeah. No, it's totally, I mean, I know that's what they were going for, because it's pretty fucking clear.
Yeah, there's a cord, there's pink goo everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean,
goddamn.
Fuck, what is this?
You know that post-birth
episode?
Pink goo?
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
If I can help it, I will never fucking know that. Post-birth.
Every birth, it's usually big rope and pink goo everywhere. Yeah, it's.
I know you want to touch heavily on Life Force. Do you mind if I mention the Funhouse real fast?
Well, I want to do something earlier.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I definitely want to touch on Eaten Alive. Mm-hmm. Which was 1976. It was the movie he did after Chainsaw. Mm-hmm. And this is just a straight up nasty piece of cinema. It really is. It's set in this sort of like backwoods, you know, sort of Texas, like redneck area. And it has one of the earliest appearances of Robert Englund.
I think the earliest.
Oh.
Yeah. No, he is a young, strapping
young
man. But he's also an asshole. He is a misogynist. Like, he basically, the movie opens with him basically trying to take more advantage of a prostitute he already paid for.
Butt stuff.
Yeah. Yeah,
trying to get butt stuff where she did not want to give the butt stuff.
Exactly, and
man, that's a thing you really got to negotiate, because that is a very
exactly
that is not a sphincter. At the moment conversation. That's got to be pre-considered.
Yeah, you can't just say I paid for my time
unless you are the person receiving the butt stuff, because then you know the quality of the butt, because then you can make the judgment.
True,
my butt is prepared for butt stuff.
Very true, very true. But, yeah, basically it centers around...
Also,
you know.
Butt Stuff Preparation sounds like a good title, too. I'm just running into... Okay, no.
Maybe not for this episode, but, you know, save that for later. But yeah, no, it opens with that, and there's basically this this disturbed girl who was who became a prostitute, ends up getting kicked out of the whorehouse or whatever, goes to this small, in the middle of the woods, sort of a little hotel situation, and there's a psychopath running it who ends up killing her and feeding her to the crocodiles, and that's kind of the whole plot of the movie. Anybody who comes over there that he doesn't like, he kills and feeds the crocodiles. And
didn't that happen in Florida?
I mean, probably.
No, it's
yeah, like in real life.
No, seriously, someone with the last name Ball. Okay, keep talking.
Yeah.
My creepy knowledge is correct. The suspected serial killer is Joseph Douglas Joe Ball. It was American murderer and serial killer, suspected serial killer, sometimes referred to as the Alligator Man, the Butcher of Elmendorf, and the Bluebeard of South Texas. He is known to have killed two and is said to have killed as many women as the 1930s, and was known to feed them to his alligators.
Which totally makes sense as a reference that Hooper would have had since he's from Texas.
It is, and yeah. It happened in the 30s, so...
So it probably was common legend in his area growing up.
Yep. I'm just glad I'm not crazy in that.
Well, no, that's great. That's awesome.
No, you're good. You're good. Okay. No, yeah, this was said.
I didn't do any research.
I didn't. I just have crazy knowledge on serial killers.
I know everything about serial killers.
Also, I got to say, quick thing. Robert Englund, and this blew my fucking mind because I hadn't seen this movie in a while. His character's name is Buck.
What does he like to do?
And he... likes to fuck.
Yeah.
And that is where Tarantino got that fucking like reference for Kill Bill. Absolutely. He said the fucking line while he is trying to take advantage of, oh my God.
Wow.
And it fucking, I was like, damn.
That's a deep cut.
It is a deep cut. Because Eating Alive is amazing.
That's a GY deep cut.
But yeah.
GY deep cut.
But yeah, basically, like, the guy who owns the place, Judd, whatever, he's offing everybody that comes through. He's got a actual crocodile from Africa and that he's feeding people to, and it's just a nasty piece of work. Like, there's a couple that comes in, he kills off the dad, the mom is all fucked up, and the daughter... He is chasing around with a scythe, and she gets under the freaking house, and Eaten Alive, very underrated, but it is a nasty, misogynist, racist, 1976 piece of work, but damn, it is perfect exploitation. That's all I'm going to say.
Now, Eaten Alive, it is funny that there is another crocodile movie in Toby Hooper's bag of tricks, and it's
another Robert Englund movie.
There's a couple other Robert Englund things. Robert Englund is definitely that he was not his first horror movie appearance wasn't as Freddy Krueger.
No, not by a long
shot. It was Eaten Alive, and then he went to do several other things, including The Mangler with Toby Hooper.
Yes.
Dance of the Dead, which was his Masters of Horror.
One of the Masters of Horror. One was The Damn Thing.
I saw all the Masters of Horror, but I don't remember The Damn Thing.
Right, but how much did we drink while we watched Masters of Horror?
I remember when those were coming out, we had movie nights, and people came over to watch Masters of Horror. That was a thing.
Man, I just got something, I think.
Nobody really talks about Hooper. He did... two movies based on Stephen King novels or books, shorts or stories.
Yep.
With Salem's Lot and then
The Mangler. Yeah.
That's true. We pay attention a lot more to the Salem's Lot than The Mangler because...
For good reason. Anyone here seen The Mangler besides me?
I have not.
Saw it years ago.
Same. But I remember enough that Robert Englund was just there to do being Robert Englund, just like weird cackle laugh.
Doesn't he have like weird makeup in the?
He's got weird makeup, and basically it's a laundry press that gets possessed by a demon, and craves blood, and so just like kills people, and then at one point, it becomes fully like self-controlled and stalks around the laundry place like a monster after the person that's trying to kill it.
Yeah.
It had to have been at the peak of Stephen King's coke days that he wrote this.
And then Hooper was like, that's what I'm going to do now.
Didn't y'all do a Beautiful Disasters on some shit like this?
Yeah,
schlock abuse?
Yeah, we did a deathbed episode. But there's also apparently a...
Well, I think you have a new one now.
No, well there's that. Yeah. But also, there was a movie that came out maybe like 2 years ago. That's about a sofa that kills people.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, shit.
And we're going to do that shit, too. So.
Fuck yeah. But Salem's Lot was actually, wasn't that one of the
ones? Let's go to the good one.
Wasn't that one of the films that launched the popularity in doing like Stephen King stories as two-part miniseries?
That was very early TV miniseries.
I think it's actually the second movie that's based off of Stephen King book, going Carrie first, and then that.
You are correct. Yes.
Yeah, but it was the first time that they did it. It was a TV miniseries.
Yeah,
with
that's right.
But yeah, so.
I think that was a good call on Hooper's part, because recognizing like just the volume of what he needed to put into the work made more sense to break it up.
Stephen King doesn't write small books.
He writes
normally.
Tomes.
Yeah.
A Stephen King short story is what we would normally call a fucking novel.
Yeah, or at least a novella.
Ugh.
Well, and they make good movies too. But I will say that as far as Toby Hooper is concerned, he has had a lot of experience in his career with TV stuff. And, you know, I'm not going to go through any of it, but a lot of the shit that you might have seen over the years, he might have been involved with.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
True.
He was involved with Taken, the Steven Spielberg produced, Alien Abduction series.
He also did Amazing Stories Spielberg produced as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So like he has a lot of TV credits. Just saying, like, he's been around.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with one of the things that I found is that a lot of people described him as having a very even keel, easygoing nature to work with. And like, I think the only thing that I heard people say is like, the only problem is that like his voice is so deep that it rumbles all the fucking things on my desk. But I think it's kind of cool to note that he has like, yes, horror is his bread and butter. It is what he is so fucking talented at. But when we examine, like, his very first film was back in 69, and it was a film called Eggshells, and it was very much a hippie film. And I think that in a lot of ways, those hippie characters did inform what he would utilize in varying degrees for Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Well, and at least the van characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but also, like, when we're talking about like the breakdown of the hippie movement, mm-hmm. we do still get the Sawyer family in characters like in the second one in Chop Top, who was served in the Vietnam War. And, you know, and I think that those are a lot of like underlying Vietnam influences, yeah. which was heavily involved in like those hippie feelings in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And so it's really interesting to see that. And in between, you know, Eggshells and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he did the Peter, Paul, and Mary Song is Love documentary, because that's what you fucking do.
Clearly. Then you see, after he does Texas Chainsaw, he ends up doing the Dancing with Myself music video for Billy Idol. So there is definitely a change in tone.
No, there's not, because he already did that with Gunnar Hansen dancing with a fucking chainsaw. So he knew what Dancing with Myself is.
That's
like.
Dancing with My Saw. That's a different thing entirely.
Saw's an extension of the self, Hobbit.
So he's associated with horror, but then he does attempt to branch out to sci-fi.
He does.
You know, I mean...
No, he
Invaders from Mars.
He did a great.
Oh no, I own Invaders from Mars, and it is so underappreciated. I love it so much. It's a remake, and it's so campy and so high contrast color craziness.
He knew
that's
what
the
it
movie
was
that made me
made
scared
it.
Of Karen Black, though, because I
oh yeah
couldn't figure out what her deal was or why she looked so weird. Karen Black.
Invaders from Mars. I looked. To see if it was available streaming anywhere, even though I have it on DVD, and I've seen it more times than I can count, but it is not. It is one of those lost films that you have to find. Like, it's out of print, I think.
Or Groots owns it.
I own it. I mean, if Groots owns it.
It's a library.
I lent it to that motherfucker, but I will say, she has one of those faces, and I'm not going to say that she's not a beautiful woman, but I'm going to say she's kind of like the Willem Dafoe
yes.
Of Scream Queens, okay? She like, just has a face that is just that will terrify you.
She looks like she lost consciousness. She has a gaping maw.
Is that what you're
saying? No, that's for Urza-Bulk.
Oh, fair.
I love her. I don't want to get anyone to get this fucking twisted. I love her, but holy
she
hell,
does have
mouth.
A gaping maw. Yeah,
like she has a bite size that I fucking envy.
She's the bite size of the turnaround in Fright Night.
That's, yes,
that's just for Urza-Bulk.
All right, so I basically need to meet her.
Yeah. Definitely.
So I think this is a logical segue to go into Life Force. Has anyone other than me watched The Funhouse?
No, yeah,
of course
I haven't.
Okay,
I mean,
Groots, what haven't you fucking seen?
But I mean, The Funhouse. I mean, it has oh God, now I'm forgetting the name.
I'm terrible with actors.
It's the same girl that was the wife in Amadeus.
That one.
I unfortunately don't know.
No.
But I think main takeaway that we need to pull from Funhouse, number one, the cover is misleading because there are no fucking clowns in the movie.
That's why I haven't watched it.
There are no clowns in the movie. It heavily leans on the freak show aspects of carnivals. And, yeah, you know, like, what if the freaks are hidden in plain sight? That sort of thing. Like, what if the people wearing masks are actually, like, more hideous underneath, that sort of thing.
That's a worry I have every day nowadays.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's why I wear masks. The wonderful thing that I really enjoyed about The Funhouse, because I have had a copy of The Funhouse for a long time and watched it finally recently, and Toby Hooper's brilliance with reinforcing that claustrophobic, no escape atmosphere that he started building in films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and, you know, things like that, because that was only like 5 years, somewhere between like 6 years ahead of that. And that no escape feeling where, like, I went into this thinking it was going to be kind of a goofy film, and I ended up feeling like really apprehensive and claustrophobic and realizing there was no escape for these characters. How are they going to get out of this place? What was going to happen to them?
Yeah.
And every sound, I was on edge where I was like, oh my fucking God.
Nice.
And it's honestly a very underrated film of his because, like, so it's, you know, they go, these teenagers, they decide, I think they're maybe in their 20s. I might be understating that, but, you know, they're smoking weed, doing whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the carnival and they decide to spend the night in the fucking funhouse like a bunch of psychopaths. So they're like, we're going to get off the ride and we're going to fuck in the funhouse.
It's always that one guy being like, wouldn't this be fun, guys?
That's literally what the fuck happened. Yep. But it's the same dude that at the beginning of the film, the chick goes, he's such a great guy. And she's like, Richie, if you would think Charles Manson is a good guy when you're stoned.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Berridge.
Oh, thank you.
That's the one. So
now we got to get into Life Force. We need to spend a little bit of time on Life Force before we get out of here. Because holy shit, talk about a bonkers fucking movie,
right?
Where he got carte blanche to do whatever the fuck he wanted to,
brilliant space opera.
Fully did. He fully did.
Also,
space vampires.
Can basically. We? No, literally, because that's the name of the book it was based on.
Yeah,
right. Exactly.
But.
Can we talk about Steve Railsback and Matilda May?
Oh, I was going to say, can we talk about Matilda May being naked for an hour of the film?
Oh, yes, my God. We can talk about that.
Bless you, Matilda May, and that booty.
I know. Why is she not at more horror cons? Come on.
I don't know.
Because there are too many people that are going to not handle that well, probably. I mean,
and that's why you got a fucking handler
Linnea Quigley and Dee Wallace already have to deal with enough.
I met Steve Railsback a couple times. He's awesome.
Look, Tracy Lords was at fucking
yeah, I met
Scares
her.
The Care. Everyone was chill.
I got that shit.
Life Force. If you have not had a chance to see it, and I feel like that's, for many people that aren't like deep dive into Toby Hooper, is like the hidden gem that they're going to find.
They really need
Life
to
Force
find it.
Because it is absolutely fucking bonkers.
Right.
It's weirdly sexual.
I wouldn't even say weirdly sexual. It is outright
sexual.
It is the overt sexuality of vampirism combined with like the mystique of aliens.
Yeah.
And it, in that way, like, you have a naked woman exerting her power over people, and unabashedly, and they mention like a variety of sexual kinks throughout that movie, and it is a phenomenal blend of sci-fi pacing with horror elements, because
you don't get Species without Life Force.
No, you don't. Yeah. You don't get any of the fucking sexuality. And the scene that I want to mention that like gave me the weirdest femme boner was when all of the blood drains out of Patrick Stewart and the other guy that I don't give a fuck about and becomes Matilda May and then seeps out of the helicopter, because that was so brilliant.
I feel like maybe if a different studio besides Canon had made this movie, it might have had more of an impression. More people know about it these days.
Sure.
Canon, you know, would throw money at productions, not so much on the promoting it or getting it out like word of mouth wise. So I feel like it kind of sucks. Like Hooper invested a lot into this, and if it had been like a 20th Century Fox or Warner Brothers, it might be something more people know about these days.
But also it may not have been what we came to know Life Force to be. So
that's true.
A bigger studio is going to end up fucking with it more probably too. So like the reason why it is Life Force as we know it is because Canon was like, fuck it. We got a lot of weird shit. Who cares?
Right, but coming off of Poltergeist, like, he got a lot of offers from studios, so.
It's also weird because the actual film was cut by 14 minutes.
Really?
Yep.
For, they had it, the theatrical release was, like, the full movie, which is called now the director's cut. However, 14 minutes was chopped out for like most of the overseas stuff, like UK and whatnot. And,
okay.
And then that happened somewhere in the States as well. Some releases. I also do want to say, you mentioned earlier, Patrick Stewart was in that early role in film.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Now,
doesn't have hair in that.
I want to do kind of.
He has the ring.
I want to do a rapid fire at the end here of some of the other films that people should check out before we get done, because we're right at the tail end here. But
yes.
Toolbox Murders doesn't get enough credit. It's got Juliet Landau is in it, who was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer as Spike's girlfriend.
Oh, shit. Right.
And she's like,
is she related to Martin?
I'm not sure offhand, actually. But well, I will
you didn't
say
do
that,
your research?
That she jogs a lot in that film, and she's wearing very tight clothing, and her assets as an actress are very clear in that
I think
film.
It's clear you're not as good of a podcaster as Murphy right now, because she does her research.
Okay.
I've been doing this long enough that I know that I can just like phone it in and have other people do research for me.
Please
so,
don't make me compete with Hobbit.
I would say like Toolbox Murders, Mortuary is not a bad. It's not a great film, but it's not bad.
Martin Landau was her dad.
Was it Martin Landau?
Martin Landau is
okay.
Is
really, it was? I mean, that's a pretty unique name. That's why I was asking.
Yeah. Was Spike's girlfriend in Buffy the Vampire Slayer? That's Juliet Landau. So
you should have known that, dude.
Yep, Martin Landau.
The hell's your nerd cred now? Right now,
apparently in the toilet. So, So Toolbox Murders, definitely worth a check out. It's a whole like murderer in an apartment building fucking thing, and it's goofy, it's campy, it's not doing anything special, but it's fun and it's worth a fucking watch.
I want to talk about his segment in the co-produced, co-directed Body Bags situation.
Okay,
from 1993. Yeah, no, he did the last of the three segments called The Eye with Mark Hamill.
Which is so good. I really liked that.
It was amazing. However, I rewatched it just recently, and I hadn't seen it in a long time. And of course, I it was on Shudder in high definition. Never seen it before in high definition. I probably watched it on VHS the last time I saw it.
That's bullshit. I've seen your DVD collection.
So, all right. So we got Mark Hamill as like a, you know, up and coming baseball player with a, you know, with a wife that he loves very much, played by Twiggy, like a kind of a supermodel from like the like late 60s, early 70s, now acting. And there was a cameo by Roger Corman as a fucking doctor. That was awesome. However, he gets in a car crash. His eye comes out. He has to get an eye eye transplant, and he gets a serial killer's eye, etc. That's the whole fucking plot. One scene where he gets a little aggressive sexually with his wife.
He balls a girl down.
He does. And I did not remember this, but it looks like actual explicit sex. And you can clearly see Mark Hamill's taint and balls.
That's a GOI Night subject. What are you doing, man?
Yeah, taint and balls. Sorry. Mark Hamill's taint and balls.
Sorry.
Tell me about Mark Hamill's taint and balls, damn it.
The force was with him. Yeah.
Oh,
no. It was a great, you know, part of that movie, but damn.
You're saying you can see Luke Skywalker's taint is what you're pretty much saying.
Yeah, pretty. Yeah. All right. I mean, dude, it was shocking. Shocking.
And also shocking, we went over on this episode, literally every episode that we ever do. You know what? It was for a good reason. We love Tobe Hooper. Even post-2000 Tobe Hooper, as bad as some of those films were, it's still worth a watch just to really kind of inform you as to the nature of the director. And it's a true master of horror and very well worth our time to focus on him during the Halloween season. We do a director every season of GUI, and so I'm really glad to really talk about Texas Chainsaw and Poltergeist and all the rest on this episode. We're going to find you next time for another episode of Geeks on the Influence. Stay tuned next week for GUI Nights, talking about
GUI
how much Poltergeist scarred us as children, I think is the conversation.
Yeah, we're going to get into it.
And I'm going to find you next time for the very last Halloween or Potoween episode of Geeks Under the Influence,
what?
Which is going to be campfire stories.
On
the last episode. So I'm Mike the Hobbit, and as we say here, join us or die.
Shut the fuck up, Hobbit.
She said it.
Join us or die. Join us or die, or I will swallow your soul.
GUIPodcast.com.
Can you say hello to Daddy?
Hello, Daddy.